Yes, you're wrong. The podcast where we talk trash about the things people love to hate and hate to love. And we're your hosts, Shelby and Matt.
Oh, for God's sakes, it's just a flying saucer, Ed. We gotta go. Is there a better line that Kirsten Dunst has uttered in her entire career? I think not. That's my favorite.
Yeah, no. I was watching it waiting to figure out which one was your favorite. I had questions. It wasn't my oversell, favorite series.
Did I oversell that one scene where they're heading out of the hotel and the UFO comes down and she's like, oh my gosh, come on.
I just don't get the UFO thing. I really don't. Like, what was the point?
I mean,
is that a thing? Is Fargo, the show, like usually dealing with some sort of paranormal light or otherworldliness?
No, not really. Although the
thing is, like, a fun little flavor.
I think the thing with Fargo as a series and also as a movie and just like the Coen brothers stuff in general is that it's like mushing things together that normally wouldn't be mashed together. So it's like you think like there's always some sort of crime, but then it gets complicated by something else. And so then the people who are trying to solve the crime are confused because they're like, wait, we thought that this was just straightforward crime. And it's like, no, actually part of this has sort of nothing to do with the crime. And it's going to be impossible for you to figure out. And so I think that the UFO angle was just like another version of that.
Okay, yeah. Well, this isn't a Fargo episode. Let's just clear the air there.
But it could become one. I actually didn't watch the last
Fargo
season.
Featured so heavily in your appreciation of Kirsten Dunst, I probably would have picked someone else. TBH.
Interesting. Okay. So we're off to a bad start. You're regretting your choices already.
No, I'm happy to talk about Kirsten Dunst. I walked away from this preparation feeling like, oh, I think I could be friends with Kirsten Dunst. Like, I think she would allow that. You know, I just have to move into her neighborhood, which is more feasible than like living next to the Kardashians, because Kirsten Dunst is a normal celebrity, right?
She's Wait, where a normal does she celebrity. Live?
She lives in the Valley. She's like, I just can't do Hollywood. I can't do Calabasas. She's like, in all her interviews, she's like, oh, let's go to this dive bar in the neighborhood. She's like talking about going to PTA meetings and like seeing neighbors at pickup and whatnot. And she just seems kind of relaxed in not feeling too self-conscious of her fame. And so I really do think if I ran into her at a park, I have done enough practice that I could ease into approaching her to be her friend.
Well, yeah, because you famously have done a lot of practice in just approaching strangers at parks, your favorite activity.
Yeah, and our
Some
kids
would
are,
say
I
creepy,
mean,
but I guess
like
maybe it's it
we have
prepared
similarities.
You for this.
I would be able to be like, oh my gosh, what school did you put him in? You know, like we're looking for Penny too, you know? And then suddenly she'd be telling me, the day would pass, and then she'd be like, oh, Jesse's making burgers. You guys want to come over? And we'd be like, no, we don't want to put you out, but also yes. And then it's like, ba 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 boom. There we are.
Well, the beauty of you, you know, one of your many great attributes is that you do have the ability to always seem incredibly bored, which I think would work well in a celebrity meeting context, because I think most people would come across like as too eager and needy, but would definitely have a lot of sort of like cool girl on we going on.
Yeah, just indifferent. Yeah.
Right,
just like,
exactly.
Oh, yeah, take it or leave it. Like, yeah.
Right.
This is just a normal Tuesday for
right
me.
No, she would be more eager to please you than the other way around.
That's how I like it, you know. That's the power dynamic I strive for,
which is the power dynamic we have here, so
yeah.
meeting, and honestly, this is
going so strong.
This is a different element altogether. But I have now had multiple people. Well, this is like a trend of my life. This isn't a new thing. But multiple people say that I have the energy of a high school cheerleader, and so. And I feel like Kirsten Dunst has that energy in a lot of ways. So maybe that
I disagree.
You being friends with me has just trained you for that.
I don't, no offense to you. Like, I acknowledge our friendship and I value it. But you guys are completely
you don't think we're
different
the same
individuals.
People?
I really don't see the similarities.
Maybe I'm more similar to her characters than to her as a person.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably. Your melancholia meets Bring It On, dabbled with some Drop Dead Gorgeous and I guess the Virgin Suicides. Like, I don't, like, where are we going?
Spider-Man. Yeah, I'm a journalist, like in Civil War.
Never forget.
I honestly, so we, when you picked this episode, I was like, wait, like, didn't we sort of already do her? But then I realized that in my mind, she's just like, we did Natalie Portman for my birthday. And I feel like in some ways, they're very different people, but they have sort of like similar trajectories to their careers, I think, in some ways. So I'm excited to discuss that as well as we go through this. Because even right then, I was like, oh, yeah, and she was in Star Wars. And then I was like, no, Kirsten Dunst was not in Star Wars. Kirsten Dunst was in Spider-Man. But around the same time and sort of giving similar energy in some ways.
Well, I see your point because I think it's like they're like 90s child stars who came out relatively unscathed. And they seem very sure of themselves and kind of less glamorized, like less concerned with the star power they carry, I guess. But I was thinking about this too, and as I was reading more like interviews with Kirsten Dunst, and part of the reason I was like, oh, I could be her friend, is that she sort of doesn't respect this this career at all. Like, she's not like, you know, because Natalie Portman can be kind of try hard, and like even Scarlett Johansson, who's a similar like child star who's now a serious auteur. It just seems like there's this, oh yeah, everything we do is so important, and like I really study my characters out, and like I choose my roles so carefully. And Kirsten Dunst, famously over the last two press cycles, especially with Civil War, it's just like shooting the breeze, being like, yeah, I guess I'd do another Marvel movie. They pay great. And everyone's like, oh, you're not supposed to say that. And she's like, why? That's why people do those movies. And she'll just like say things, you know, she just shares her opinion. And her opinion is usually something I really appreciate and identify with, like, especially with this Civil War, like, movie being so politically charged, or I guess anti-war and whatnot. She's like, ugh, I guess I'm voting for Biden. No good options this time. And like, everything's broken. Everything needs to be fixed. It's just money, money, money that's making everything, like, it's just shocking that we're in this position again, is what she said. And then like someone asked her about what she thought of Jonathan Glazer's acceptance speech, where there's like 1,000 people signed a letter condemning his speech.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, she was like, I don't get it. My interpretation was he was saying genocide is bad. And it's like, she's just like, yeah, it should be this obvious. But my absolute favorite Kirsten Dunst moment, and honestly something that's been trending again on like TikTok and whatnot, was in 2016, she was on one of those Hollywood actresses roundtables. And all these women were like bemoaning, oh yeah, I wish there were more female directors to work with. I like, you know, it's just so hard that there's no female directors on my show or in my movies. And Kirsten just like jumps in and she's like, you know what's so funny? I've worked with so many female directors. And everyone's like, oh really? Who? And she's like, blah, 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 and lists them all. And she's like, I think it's just like up to actresses to choose female directors. And I was like, yeah, it's like she really does just state the obvious, but it's like there's no jumping around it. She kind of puts her money where her mouth is, and she really does like choose the most random roles or kind of fills in the gaps in between her, you know, notable parts to just do what interests her and to follow the people who inspire her. And to this point, she's like, I'm less interested in the script and more interested in the director and like working with people that she likes and respects. And a lot of them do turn out to be women. So she's a ladies' lady.
And we love that. I also loved on the most recent press tour where she's talking about how like she's not going to get like plastic surgery and stuff. Because she's like, these people look crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just like, God bless her. What a gem. But she seems like she's always sort of had that attitude to her to a certain degree.
The Power of the Dog or something, she was like talking about method acting. And she's like, how am I supposed to do that? Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, that just seems like something only men can afford to do. And I was like,
because was she the one who's like, what am I going to do? Go home to my kid and pretend to be, you know?
Yeah. She's like speaking in an accent. Like, honestly, I can't do that. It seems like something only men can afford to do is her quote, which I'm going to get stitched on a pillow and hold it in the movie theater.
Baby's first tattoo. Here we come.
Yeah. So she seems chill, and it's interesting now, like, sort of looking at her career, which has been going, you know, 30 years now, and having some big roles, but kind of a lack of industry respect, at least until recently. It's been interesting revisiting it for this episode and thinking about how she frames it now and, like, how she processes it now. But also, like, what she brought to these roles that were maybe kind of thankless at the time.
Well, I think also she, I think that one of the things that you see a lot of actresses do, and this is like maybe more the Natalie Portman route, is that they're like so desperate to be taken seriously after they've sort of had their, you know, like high school movies and rom-coms and whatever, that then they just pick a bunch of sort of like really strenuous, depressing projects to do. And I feel like Kirsten Dunst really doesn't do that much. Like as of late, she's had more of those, but it's not like she's really like gone out of her way to find them. I think they've sort of just like found her, and this is like much later in her career, you know. Like Anne Hathaway, if you look at like her 20s, she has like lots of like really sort of like weird, depressing, sad, serious movies that like didn't do well, but she's like, I gotta prove myself that I'm like not just this like young actress. And Kirsten Dunst was like mostly in, you know, random kind of like rom-commy fun type things until what, like Melancholia almost, which is pretty late in her career.
Right after Melancholia, she specifically was like, I don't want to be cast as this sad mom all the time. And so then she did a comedy right after that. So there's sort of this like resistance to being typecast, even if that typecast would lend her to more of these showy award hunty type of pieces,
which that's similar to what Anne Hathaway has said on this award cycle for, or this interview cycle for, what's the Idea of You, of how she doesn't want to get typecast in like awards movies. She just like wants to have fun and do kind of whatever she wants. And so that's part of the reason why she wanted to do this, to prove that she can sort of do whatever.
And that's,
and it is really nice, like, when you have really talented people doing those kind of movies, because it's it works better than when you have sucky hot people trying to just clomp their way through them.
Well, and it's nice to like see someone, because, you know, child stars are, it's usually just horrific. Like, it's just bad. And like watching documentaries like Quiet on Set about the Nickelodeon shows and whatnot, like there are so many ways that acting as a child, working as a child, can go wrong. And I think for this generation of women, like Natalie Portman, like Scarlett Johansson and Kirsten Dunst, they were lucky to be just at the cusp of social media becoming a thing. So kind of the last round of, you know, celeb before we felt entitled to their every move. But I think it's the way Kirsten Dunst talks about her childhood and like how she got into acting. It seems like the thing that grounds her is just this like normalcy around her family. And she's still best friends with like her childhood neighbor, who's just an, you know, normie like us. Another reason I could definitely infiltrate her friend group. But I think it's just refreshing to see someone whose parents weren't like ka-ching, like, we got to get this going. Like, someone said, you're cute in a mall. So now, boom, 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 work, 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 work. Like, she was doing movies during high school or whatnot, but it wasn't her everything. You know, she wasn't mainly attending school on set with a lazy, you know, tutor. It was like she still was able to build a foundation for kind of like an escape from the Hollywood glamour bot. And she credits her mom with really having her back and like building up her sense of self. But also she acknowledges that she thinks a lot of that self-respect and strength and empowerment came from working with female directors from a very early start in her career.
Interesting. What was like the earliest?
It was female? The Little Women, which was right after filming Interview with a Vampire. And she said that going from such a masculine set to somewhere where it was like just women, not only with this female cast, but also the director and like the producers and whatnot, and how, you know, protective they were of her and like how fun it was to work with women and like how everyone was just, you know, complimentary and sweet. And then of course The Virgin Suicides, Sofia Coppola.
Oh yeah.
And how that's how she thought she was cool, is that the studio was like, maybe you should get your fix your teeth, or like, you know, try dressing like this on the red carpet or whatnot. And Sofia was the one who was like, oh no, you're gorgeous. Like, you're beautiful. You look great. And like, don't change a thing. And having this cool, you know, woman that she looked up to say that to her as a young teen was like foundational for her to be like, oh, well then these dudes in suits don't matter because this cool person thinks I'm cool and beautiful and pretty and talented. So like, whatever. And she's like, yeah, I think it worked out well. I think it's proof that women need women in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And men need women.
And yes.
Gay specifically.
Please. But no, yeah, she has an interesting career. I mean, you had not seen some of the earlier stuff that I had, so I had to catch up on some of her later stuff. But what was the first movie you remember seeing her in?
I think the first movie I remember seeing her in was Spider-Man. But I do have distinct memories of seeing the trailer for Bring It On a lot. I feel like that, like, you know, was on TV and stuff. And it was sort of look at this horrible, sinful movie. Because one of the clips that they showed in the trailer is when she's like topless in front of the school assembly.
Oh, yeah.
Which, having now watched the movie recently, is like a dream sequence. But yeah, in my mind, I was like, wow, this like skanky cheerleader, like taking her top off in front of everybody. Like, this is like sinful. Like, I can't believe anybody would watch this. So then I saw Spider-Man, which obviously has like the famous upside down kiss and everything. And I loved the Spider-Man movies. So I saw the second one, saw the third one. And then I feel like I probably didn't watch like another. I'm trying to like, when did I then become a big fan of her? I feel like it was probably not until
Fargo.
Well, yeah, I'm like, probably it was actually like Fargo, because Fargo came out in what year was that? 2015. And then at that point, that was also around the time that The Beguiled came out, and I was like, oh, I just like, I'm so interested in this woman. And so then I went back and watched, you know, the Sofia Coppola movies, and I saw Elizabethtown and Mona Lisa Smile. I like went back and watched a bunch of her movies, but for whatever reason, yeah, I watched a bunch of the sort of like late half of the career movies. Yeah. So I hadn't seen a lot of the earlier stuff. Although I guess I saw Small Soldiers when it was out. So I guess I saw her in that, but I didn't really register that it was her probably at that point. Yeah. I've seen the Little Women version whenever the new Little Women came out. And then we watched Interview with the Vampire for the podcast when we did the Tom Cruise episode. So it's like, so now I feel like I've seen a lot of her movies, but it wasn't like I was watching them as they came out. Like, probably the only things that I saw like in theaters of her are like the Spider-Man movies, and then from like The Beguiled on. I guess I saw Hidden Figures and Midnight Special also in theaters.
Yeah, no, I realized that like I've grown up with her. Like it wasn't like she was someone I sought out, but I've like, I grew up on Little Women and I definitely watched Jumanji half a dozen times in my tween years. I definitely clocked that she was the voice of young Anastasia. And I watched Tower of Terror, which was a made-for-TV movie that she's also in 97. I think about that one more than I should. It's truly terrible, but honestly iconic. And then I did watch Drop Dead Gorgeous as a teen. I did watch her weirder stuff like Dick and Bring It On and Get Over It. And like, I don't know, I guess I was always, you know, then you have Spider-Man, Mona Lisa Smile. I saw Wimbledon. I saw Elizabethtown. I saw Marie Antoinette as they were coming out. So I was on the train and I didn't even realize it really. Because she isn't someone I would have like listed as a favorite. And honestly, some of those I actively did not like, such as Elizabethtown and Marie Antoinette.
Rude.
I know. But I do think it's interesting how, you know, a lot of people do think she chooses these roles that tend to be ahead of their time, like, and end up being sort of cult favorites, because Bring It On was panned, Marie Antoinette was panned, Melancholia was sort of panned, at least on the audience level. And yet these are all films that now people are revisiting and appreciating and talking about and thinking, wow, iconic.
I think of the movies on this list that I have seen, the only two that I would say are bad movies are Spider-Man 3, obviously, which is just like a train wreck in 9 million different ways, and Mona Lisa Smile, which I also think is a really bad movie.
Yeah, that was
but
bad.
Otherwise, I like or love everything else that she's been in. I'm like, she has good taste. And yes, I do think that she's what has been ahead of her time in a lot of ways.
I mean, All Good Things, which is the Ryan Gosling, like,
I didn't see that
movie. That was bad. Like, there's been some bad ones. Even, like, Bring It On is technically horrific to watch now, I feel like.
Oh, I loved it. I'm curious. I loved it.
That does not age well, you know. It's pretty problematic across the board.
You mean, does he speak fag? A great line. I'm like, I'm going to start using that. I am. Okay. I will get back to Bring It On, I'm sure, at some point. But yeah, I do have a question. So, at the beginning of the movie, Eliza Dushku has like this weird hairstyle where her hair is like almost in like ropes, sort of, but they're not like, they're like oiled kind of or something. They're not like braids or dreadlocks or something. It was a hairstyle that I have never seen before. And I was like, what is this? And like, was this a thing in the 90s?
Yeah, those are like,
do you know
dreads.
What I'm talking about?
Yeah, like, what? That's definitely like, that was a thing.
What was it?
Kids in my school were trying to do it. They're like dreads. They're like the beginning of dreadlocks. It's like early stage dreadlocks.
But then it's like she has them in one day and then she doesn't have them the next day.
Yeah, because it's just dirty hair. You just kind of roll together.
Oh, that's how that, okay. So that's what a dreadlock looks like first, and then if you keep doing it, it becomes like an actual dreadlock?
I think so. I mean,
I'm like, I actually have no idea of how you make a dreadlock either. Because white people can have dreadlocks.
Yeah.
Do you need curly hair for it? Or could like I have like could you have dreadlocks?
It's just like messing up your hair and eventually like ratting it and making it more and more dirty, and then it starts to just like grow out in these I don't know if there's a secret to it, but that's how it was presented to me as a child. That's how the kids in high school talked about it. It's like, oh, we could totally start dreads right now, like your hair's so dirty type thing.
Okay, so she had the beginnings of dreads. That's what that was.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. Okay.
Well, maybe there is. I'm obviously not like a fashion guru, and I couldn't speak to like all the technical names and hair trends of our eras, but that's how I would describe it. Yes.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
If you're a listener and you know more about this, write it, because yeah. I am intrigued.
Yeah. But anyways, should we go through her filmography, her whole
yes.
thing?
Yes. Yes, let's do it.
Let's do it.
It's long, but I feel like there's stuff we can but then there's lots of, you're like, she's in 6 movies this year, and it's like, okay, but 2 of them were voice performances and one of them was a cameo and one of them was a short film, you know. If there's one thing about Kirsten Dunst, she loves to just pop into something for a minute. Yeah. Like if somebody calls her and is like, "Hey, can you come to set for 2 days and do this?" She'll be like, "Yeah, sure, literally, I'll do that."
Yeah. The bling ring. Hello. But no, it's interesting, her number one Rotten Tomatoes score is actually her first movie, which is Kiki's Delivery Service, which is a Miyazaki anime where she voices Kiki.
Oh yeah, where she ever watched this. I have seen Kiki's Delivery Service, but I believe that I watched it.
Oh, you watched it with subtitles.
Yeah, because I didn't see it as a child. I saw it as an adult. So
yeah, cute.
I'm not watching the dubbed versions of these movies as an adult. I'll just read the thing.
I feel like, yeah, I guess that's true. That's true. Well, but like, then her big break is obviously.
Well, I was going to say, like, I know a lot of people do like the dubbed versions of the Miyazaki movies. Mm-hmm. Because I think, like, especially that's what you would watch growing up. And so, people are attached to them or whatnot. Because Anne Hathaway did the voice for one of them. And so I did. I don't think it was a Miyazaki movie, but it was some like anime thing. And I watched that and I was like, I don't love this. Because like the voices don't match up with the faces. Yeah. And like, this is confusing. I would just rather read the thing now that I am an avid reader who can read subtitles.
Exactly. Yeah.
But anyhow.
Come so far. But no, her big break is 1994, which is when she does Interview with a Vampire and Little Women, which is honestly a 1-2 punch right there. Like, I don't love Interview with a Vampire, but I do think she's a pretty good creep.
Interview with a Vampire is such it's such a gift as a performer, as a child, because you're a child playing an adult, basically, or a 1,000-year-old, you know, creature or whatever. So you get so much more of like a weird, creepy, interesting character than most child actors who burst onto the scene, you know, like playing a kid in something.
Yeah.
So you can see why, like, she got nominated for awards and, you know, it was this like very buzzy performance, especially because it's
I don't think she was nominated.
Was she?
I don't think it was very well received.
But I think she was well, or maybe she didn't get nominated for awards, but like she was well received in the performance.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't like people were like, oh, she's bad.
No, yeah.
Like, no, she didn't get like an Oscar or anything, but I'm like.
No, yeah.
She was, she got a Golden Globe nomination.
Oh, okay.
Best Supporting Actress, Interview with a Vampire. But yeah, so she, you can see why like, that is an interesting role. And then obviously you have Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise in the movie. So it's this big buzzy thing. And then, yeah, at the same time, you're getting Little Women, which is a very, very different performance that is a child performance.
I love this Little Women. I grew up on it and I loved, I probably went through a phase where I hated Amy in this, because I think a lot of people grow up hating Amy, and that's something girls have to contend with, you know, in their re-education of internalized misogyny. But now I have a deep love for Amy, and I think young Amy here, Kirsten Dunst, it will forever be one of my favorite roles of her, because the way she kind of embodies that role in a physicality that, obviously, I love Florence Pugh's Amy too, and I like that they let her be the character of the whole film, but there's something just so wonderful about Kirsten Dunst and her, I don't know, she just has that like little that level of charisma, I guess. And it's, a lot of people like talk about like, oh, her eyes, they're just so deep and soul, you know. She has such an old soul. I don't know what it is, but she's good, and I think this movie is a good tell of it, because it's those simple things of how she, you know, clings to her Christmas orange or like yells up at Joe and whatnot. I think there's a really subtle tone to her performance in this that I love. And like, no one remembers the older Amy. The adult Amy is like so beyond forgettable. It's like, get out of here, give us back.
Who even plays the adult Amy?
I don't know. Not anyone I remember. I don't think it was anyone famous, at least not anymore. Or not like when I started processing, you know, celebrity.
Well, I read the book Little Women when the Greta Gerwig version was going to come out. And I was like, oh my gosh, I love Amy as a character. I'm like, I relate to her so much. like from the jump, I'm like, everything she's saying or doing like makes 100% sense to me. So then when it was like, everybody hates Amy, I'm like, what? Like, wait a second. I don't like this. But Florence Pugh, I think, does such a good job with it. And then, yeah, I went back and watched this version. And Kirsten Dunst just has a charisma, like, even as a child, where, like, honestly, Kirsten Dunst should have played Emma, I feel like, at some point in her career, because she just, like, has that ability to somehow be, like,
it's like, basically Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, where she's, like, she's somehow likable even when she's kind of like an unlikable person in a weird way. She just like has this charm to her. And she definitely has that here even as a child as Amy. Because, yeah, like you don't necessarily like Amy. And I think Florence Pugh has something similar in just like a different variety. But I love Kirsten Dunst as Amy.
I know. Her using the clothespin on her nose. I mean, yeah. And then you have in 95, Jumanji, which is another iconic role for me personally. And I like that this is like stacked up and they're not really similar characters. You know, I feel like Abigail Breslin was like always just the saddest child you can imagine. It was just, she was cast because she could cry on cue. Or like, you know, Dakota Fanning, who's so talented, always had this sort of niche that she fit in. But these, you know, you have this Interview with a Vampire role where she's literally psychotic, bloodthirsty little baby demon, and then Little Women where she's sort of this little brat who you can't help but love, and then Jumanji, she's just this snarky early teen who's just mad at the world and doesn't want to like deal. And I love it. I mean, I honestly think this is a great film and more people should respect it.
I have not seen this version of Jumanji. I saw I've seen the new two versions, which I liked. I also saw Zathura with Kirsten Stewart. But yeah, no, I never saw Jumanji for whatever reason. I'm sure I'll see it at some point because I do love Robin Williams too. Maybe at some point we'll do an episode on him.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, who else is in it?
I have no idea.
What's her name? I don't know, but yeah, no, iconic. Iconic.
Michelle Williams. Then in 1996, she has a movie called Mother Night, which she plays like a young somebody in it, based on a Kurt Vonnegut novel. Did not see that. Then 1997, we have Anastasia, where she voices young Anastasia. Iconic. And then also Wag the Dog. Did you ever see that movie?
No.
It's a Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro movie. And I've heard a lot about it because I think it's like there's some sort of like presidential scandal, so they come up with like a fake war to try to hide the scandal, which I'm like, that seems like something that is potentially interesting on probably didn't age well, but I'm unsure of what character she plays in that movie.
Yeah, I tried to find clips of her and it wasn't really anything, so
but I feel like this is one of those things where you're early enough in your career where it's kind of like sometimes there's like if she filmed something before and it didn't come out for a couple years or whatever, like she could basically have no speaking roles or, you know, like be in one scene, like how Stephanie Hsu is in The Fall Guy for all of 3 seconds, even though she was nominated for an Oscar 2 years ago. But also then in 1998, we have Small Soldiers, which is this is such a weird movie in my mind because the movie was rated PG-13, so we weren't allowed to watch the movie initially, but it was like the marketing for it was everywhere. So we had all the toys and like a t-shirt and stuff for this movie that we weren't allowed to watch that was about action figure is sort of like becoming. Really?
Oh, no, that just, yeah, that just sparked it for me. Yeah, that's creepy. Like, I couldn't watch that.
Yeah, it's like action figures from like, I think it came out in the post like Toy Story kind of era. And it was like, it's Toy Story, but it's more violent, where these soldiers from like different, I want to say it's like neighboring houses across the street, like the soldiers are against each other. And I think that Kirsten Dunst plays the older sister of one of the boys who has the toys. Mm. I did see that movie eventually at some point in my childhood, but did not remember it nearly as well as I just remember like the action figures. And my brother had this like sort of burgundy like tie-dye small soldiers t-shirt that he wore a lot for whatever reason, even though we hadn't seen the movie. Very strange.
It's funny. Yeah, no, I missed that one, but 99 was the big year.
Yes. Because 99, we get Drop Dead Gorgeous, mm-hmm. and also The Virgin Suicides.
Yeah. And I didn't get around to watching The Virgin Suicides. I'm sorry.
Then I will talk about The Virgin Suicides.
Okay, perfect.
So The Virgin Suicides is Sofia Coppola's first movie. And I think that Sofia Coppola and Kirsten Dunst sort of, they have, it's like a 10-year age gap between them. And obviously Sofia Coppola is the daughter of Francis Ford Coppola. She briefly did some acting that didn't go well in like The Godfather Part 3. She's also in The Phantom Menace randomly. But she decided that she wanted to be an actor, and because of nepotism, she got to make a movie based off of Jeffrey Eugenides' novel, The Virgin Suicides, which was very popular at the time. And Kirsten Dunst plays the lead. It's a weird story that doesn't quite hold up, I think, in the current era. I think the movie works better because it's from a female perspective rather than novel that's from a male perspective. But basically the novel is from like a chorus of boys, like the neighborhood boys are the narrator, about this family of five girls and how they all sort of, you know, died/killed themselves in various manners over like the period of a year. And Kirsten Dunst plays one of the sisters. And I think you just really get a sense of Sofia Coppola's sort of like sad, wistful filmmaking. She really focuses on like kind of like small issues, like things that she's it's very focused on like a couple people and a specific situation. She doesn't make these like big, broad movies, and they're usually focused on girls who are usually sad, and Kirsten Dunst just nails that so well here. And I think they became really good friends, and so Kirsten Dunst has shown up in a number of Sofia Coppola's movies over the years, whether they be for like larger roles like Marie Antoinette or just like super tiny cameos like The Bling Ring. She's in a lot of them, and that all sort of starts here. And it's been a few years since I watched this movie, and I don't know how much I would like it now, but Kirsten Dunst is obviously very infectious in it. And, you know, the soundtrack is really good, and it's just very Sofia Coppola.
Yeah, no, I saw a few clips, and there's this moment where she's like making out with a bunch of people on a roof or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, Kirsten Dunst again credits Sofia with making her so comfortable, because she was like, oh, I don't really want to, like, I'm nervous to kiss all these boys. And she's like, okay, don't kiss them. Like, you'll just snuggle into their neck or use a blanket over you guys or whatever. And it was just like another instance where that became sort of a foundation for her advocating for herself and like trusting that things can be adjusted if she's not comfortable. So that's good. And then you have Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Which is a movie that was, like, made for me in a lab. Like, yeah. Watching it, this is the greatest film ever. It's so freaking funny. It has, it's like a beauty pageant in Minnesota, and Kirstie Alley really wants her daughter to be the beauty pageant queen, and so starts murdering the other 17-year-old girls. And it's so irreverent. And so over the top, so campy. But then you have, like, really great performances. Amy Adams is in it randomly. Yeah. Like, it's just a perfect movie. And I love every second of it. Oh, it's so bonkers. And it's, like, it's there are parts of it that are, like, maybe wouldn't hold up well, but that's sort of all so outlandish that it somehow kind of works even when it's bad. Yeah, it's just absolutely incredible.
This is one.
Glad I watched it.
We used to live by a movie rental place, as one does. And they would have $5 Wednesdays where you could get five movies for $5. And as a homeschooled kid with nothing better to do, we went through a lot of movies. And this is one we picked up because, I don't know, we loved the Tooth Fairy movie. Yeah. And we did not know what we were getting into. So I just remember being, like, so confused by this film. You know, I was probably watching it when I was, like, 12. And I was just what's happening? But I've seen clips again, and it is funny.
Well, because it's a mockumentary, which I also think was, like, ahead of its time.
Yeah. We're like, what's going on here? But no,
1999, we also get Dick, the movie, which I didn't see, but this is her and Michelle Williams.
Yeah. And again, this was another movie I didn't understand because it's basically a parody of the Watergate scandal. And so it's, like, kind of meta in a sense where I don't remember. I didn't rewatch it. So all I remember is just the cloud of confusion that settled over me.
Did you watch The Crow: Salvation in 2000? Some sort of superhero movie? It's the third in a series that she's not in the first two of? I did not watch that.
Yeah, no. She was getting her paychecks.
Also, apparently, distribution was canceled on that. So it just, like, went straight to DVD. Interesting. Then 2000, we also have Bring It On. Which, yes. Okay, so you said you don't like Bring It On?
Or you think it doesn't age well. It was never, like, my favorite, probably because it was too edgy for me, you know, as a good old Mormon teen.
I feel like it aged a lot better than I thought it was going to.
I mean, there's, like, they use the, like, R slur a couple of times, and there's, like, you know, the racism issue with the whole setup and Gabrielle Union's remembrance of how they used and abused that storyline.
Like, yes, but at the same time, I think for a 2000s movie, like, the setup is that the white girls are stealing the black girls' routines.
Yeah.
And Kirsten Dunst is the main character. So I feel like I thought that the storyline was going to somehow end up with them winning anyways. But it's like, they very clearly show that the white people were doing, that what they were doing was bad, that those people were terrible. Gabrielle Union's character and her group is, like, shown as really great the entire time, and they end up winning the tournament and sort of, like, become friends with Kirsten Dunst. Like, there maybe is a little bit of, like, white savior-y kind of stuff going on at some points, but she tries to pay for them to be able to enter the competition when they don't have the money, and Gabrielle Union's like, no, like, you're not paying for us, like, we'll do this on our own. Also, Kirsten Dunst is friends with a gay character in the movie who's just, like, sort of chilling and kind of, like, has a romantic thing at the end, which I feel like is a little ahead of its time. Also, I love the boy that she falls in love with is so cute, and the teeth brushing scene is incredible.
Like, yeah,
I loved it. Having just watched it for the first time, like, 2 days ago, I'm like, I felt like this worked as a movie.
No, I mean, yes.
Also, the name Torrance, I'm like, that's a great character name.
Yeah.
I love that name. I'm going to name my child Torrance.
Did you watch Get Over It?
No, I did not.
Is that so good? It's one of those teen comedies that's a retelling of Shakespeare. This one's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Even though it's not really, but it is. And it's like, it stars, oh my gosh, what's the comedian's name from... What is his name? Only Murders in the Building.
Steve Martin. Martin Short.
The other one. Martin Short. It stars Martin Short as the director of this high school play. And then Kirsten Dunst is the girl. It's bad. It's bad is the thing. It's like trying to be 10 Things I Hate About You, you know, and it's not good. But she does sing in it, which is a thing that she wanted to do, it turns out. She like wanted to... She's like still interested in doing a musical. Like she loves singing, I guess.
She loves singing.
I wouldn't say it's the greatest song, but it was sort of like, you know how in A Walk to Remember, Mandy Moore just suddenly busts out this magical song in the middle of her stage performance? Well, that's what happens here too.
She also has two songs on the... she has two songs on the Get Over It soundtrack, but then she also apparently has a song on the Drop Dead Gorgeous soundtrack and one on the Little Women soundtrack. So she was really pumping out songs for these soundtracks. I don't know what they were exactly, but she was doing them.
Not great. Get It Over It was bad. Bring It On is beloved now. It was sort of panned at its premiere. And Crazy Beautiful is another 2001 teen romance, a little bit more serious. But I think it was a little bit more respected by the critics. I didn't see it, though, so couldn't tell you.
Her and Jay Hernandez, whoever that is, I don't know. 2001, she was also in a historical drama called The Cat's Meow that appears to be set in the 1920s, but I also did not see that.
Yeah, me neither.
Have you seen that? And then in 2002, we get Spider-Man, which has to be her biggest movie to date. Maybe Spider-Man 2 is bigger, but like she is the original Mary Jane. I feel like she is the best Mary Jane that we have had. The upside down kiss is just iconic. She like this was the original sort of superhero movie in the the reworking of it, and she is the original, you know, like superhero's girlfriend. And in my mind, she always has that role. I think she's fantastic in it. She's fun. She's funny. And it's just like everything that you want it to be. Also, she proves that she can really rock any color of hair because she's a redhead in this, and she looks great.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think this is an interesting one because, this was like, there weren't a ton of superhero movies. And then they tried around this era with like, I don't remember when Fantastic Four came out or whatever, but there was like this attempt. And this was really the only one that stuck. And she says that she was like, it felt like doing an indie film because it's like Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire, who were both kind of on the indie side. They weren't really necessarily considered blockbuster, guarantees, but this became a huge hit, and it had like such a uniquely hugely talented cast with like Willem Dafoe. And so I think it does sort of hold up. It wasn't ever, I still get the ick just looking at Tobey Maguire, but she's good. She has that sort of ingenue quality. She looks, there's like an innocence to her, but also a depth. And so she's a good fit with his weirdly old seeming Toby.
I like Toby Maguire as Spider-Man. I think he's good at like being dupey, which I think is key to Spider-Man in some ways. Like Spider-Man is too cool in the later versions. I like him dorkier. Then she's in this movie called Levity, which I have not seen, with Billy Bob Thornton and Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, no.
Did you see that? No?
No. It's one of those, like, serious ones.
Yeah, and it's an ensemble movie. I think she's the daughter of someone on parole.
Yeah.
Sounds about right. Yeah. And then we get Mona Lisa Smile, which is one of those movies that, like, they wanted to be an Oscar movie. And directed just, by a man. Like, painfully is not.
Ugh. Yeah. No, it wasn't good. But you know what? Maggie Gyllenhaal set her up with her good old brother Jake, and they dated for a couple years.
Oh, really? So, interesting. Yeah. This again speaks to my theory that Jake Gyllenhaal is gay.
What?
Because of course a gay man would choose Kirsten Dunst to date, right?
What do you mean? Why?
Because she's a gay icon.
Oh.
It's like me wanting to date Anne Hathaway, you know?
I see.
Like, you're telling me you're straight and the person you're going to pick to date is Kirsten Dunst?
Well, like, as iconic in queen? He should choose someone else? Or, like, you're just saying... I'm just saying
if you were a gay person and you were closeted and you had to pick someone to date, you would pick Kirsten Dunst.
Well, they got 2 years. So
I'm saying I need Jake Gyllenhaal to be gay. So we're going to... No, anything we need to make it work.
Yeah.
Mona Lisa Smile, Julia Roberts, who is seemingly the same age as everybody in the cast, is a teacher who's like teaching girls at Wellesley to be feminists. And it is the most like basic feminism 101. And I'm pretty sure that Kirsten Dunst plays the... Isn't she the girl who's like... I'm just going to get married. You're crazy. Like, she's the one who's really going after Julia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't great. I mean, that's why men should stay out of women's business. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that movie could have been good, but I don't think it should have been made.
It's also crazy that it's written by men.
Yeah. No, it's the dumbest setup. It's just like
why?
Yeah.
Bizarre. Then she's briefly in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and then she's in Spider-Man 2.
Which is where the pay parody thing came up, because Tobey Maguire got a huge uptick. He got like $17 million to come back, and she wasn't offered nearly as much. And it's like, she was like, well, yeah, he's the star, but it's also like she was a... established actor, you know, like she had a track record, and so that was a unfair thing, but she decided to come back anyways because, you know, what's she gonna do?
Yeah, and it's Spider-Man, and she's gonna make plenty of money off of it anyways, even if it's not as much as him.
Yeah.
2004, we also get Wimbledon, which I watched for the first time, and I enjoyed. I feel like it's a good rom-com.
Yeah, okay. I really don't remember much about it. I mean, another tennis
She's
movie.
She's a professional tennis player.
Yeah.
Who's really good.
Yeah.
He is a professional tennis player, but is like older and is about to retire. And it's his last Wimbledon and it's her first Wimbledon. And they're staying in the same hotel and they sort of like fall in love.
Okay. Then... So Wimbledon, Battle of the Sexes, Challengers, Kiss, Marry, Kill.
Oh, okay. this is easy. Obviously, you're going to kiss Challengers because Challengers is the horniest.
They're horny
movie.
But unhealthy. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm effing Challengers. Then you're going to marry Wimbledon because Paul Bettany and Kirsten Dunst, and then kill Battle of the Sexes, which I don't think is actually a good movie.
It is pretty rough. You're right. You're right. But she is a lesbian. Yeah. So. Guess you hate lesbians.
Yes, but also like Emma Stone is not good in that movie, I don't think.
Yeah.
I think the problem with that movie is that you should like Emma Stone's character more. Like that's who you should be rooting for, and somehow or another you're actually rooting for Steve Carell's horrible.
I don't think people are rooting for Steve Carell.
I mean, no, but like he's the one who's like more interesting and more charismatic, and his plot line is that like he sort of loves his wife, but he like is getting it, but she's like decided to divorce him. Where Emma Stone's plot line is that she's has no charisma and is cheating on her husband the whole time, which like, okay, yes, she's a lesbian and she's sort of forced into this marriage, but
isn't that the same plot as Marie Antoinette?
Well, Marie Antoinette is is set several hundred years before.
So it's more forgivable. Okay, so you have, I'm just curious about your rules.
I'm cheating just saying that, no, in films. I mean, I don't think anybody should be cheating on their spouse. If you want to cheat on your spouse, just break up with them. Yeah. But if you're married to the king of France, that's slightly more difficult than you could be murdered. But I just think that if you're going to make a movie, Battle of the Sexes, I should leave the movie liking Billie Jean King, which is how in real life that works. And instead, somehow, I think because Steve Carell is like a charismatic character and they gave Emma Stone nothing in that script, you leave the movie liking Steve Carell's character more than Emma Stone's character, or at the very least sort of liking them both the same, which is not the goal. Anywho.
So is your Kiss, Marry, Kill the same when you take out the actresses? Like if you're Zendaya versus Kirsten Dunst versus Emma Stone? Or does Emma Stone inch ahead somehow?
No. I think it's the same. If I'm just doing the performances, I think it's the same. Because I think the best performance is... Actually, the best performance is probably Zendaya, but I feel like it's...
Well,
like,
I mean, actresses across the board. Like, just...
Across the board.
There.
Oh, like their work and their total? Work.
Yeah.
Oh, then... If that's the case, then I'm definitely still marrying Kirsten Dunst because she has the best movies out of them. But I don't, because like the thing is, Zendaya hasn't been in that much. Like she has Dune, where she's not doing that much. She has Euphoria, which I love. She's Malcolm and Marie, which I hate. She's in the Spider-Man movies, which are like, okay, I think I have to kill Zendaya just because she does not have
much
stuff. Although I think she's better in Challengers than Emma Stone is in Battle of the Sexes.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Anyways, just
now,
just
if I had to do it with the men in those movies, I'm going to marry Paul Bettany.
Yeah.
F both of the boys in Challengers and kill Steve Carell. So there we go.
That
perfect.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Done.
For sure.
Okay. So then we get Elizabeth Town in 2005. Town. And terrible. I am an Elizabeth Town supporter.
No. Terrible. Absolutely awful.
I love the movie. The music is so good in Elizabeth Town. This is Orlando Bloom and Kirsten Dunst driving to a funeral? Someone's funeral, or she's staying at a funeral. They meet at a funeral.
His dad kills himself, I think, as he's about to kill himself. Or his dad dies. His dad definitely dies. He's trying to kill himself in the most elaborate way, which is like with his, you know, stationary bike and kitchen knives tied to the. This was seared into my memory again. It was so scarring to me. But he tries to off himself and then doesn't, and then meets this cute girl in like a red beret. I swear she's wearing a red beret.
No, she definitely is. She is the definition of a manic pixie dream girl. Like that is what this, like that came from this movie. That is the energy that she is giving. And I'll just say this. If anyone could play a very, very convincing manic pixie dream girl who makes me love them despite the fact of the trope, it is Kirsten Dunst. And somehow the entire movie, I was still like, wait, like I am then also in love with you. So I can see how this would work. Like I would also
need to dance at my funeral.
Yeah. Right. No, 100%. Like she could pitch me on any of these weird ideas, like let's get ice cream in the elevator. And I'm like, sure.
You're like, that's revolutionary.
Me and gay Jake Gyllenhaal are both like, yes. We'll do it.
Sign me up. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I have no love for that movie, so I really can't. It's there.
And then we have Marie Antoinette, which you had seen before.
Yes.
But you don't like Marie Antoinette either.
No, I like this. I think it's fun that she sort of did this. You know, it's not a period film because it's sort of... Kirsten Dunst has an American accent. She didn't have to do any studying, any work on this. It's really, it was ahead of its time in that I think if it were to come out now, it'd be seen as sort of like trite almost, but it was like interesting. It wasn't necessarily the most gripping movie. But I think it does age well. I would be curious to watch it again now. It's just not streaming anywhere. But I think it's a fascinating look at a misunderstood character. And it had a lot of fun playing with that misunderstanding.
Because she's sort of just like a sad teen girl who's like trapped in this elaborate, like, yes, world of fortune. And, you know, she has everything she wants. But at the same time, it's like she is sort of stuck in it in a lot of ways.
Okay. Have you seen this like Hailey Bailey scandal?
Hailey, Hailey Bailey?
She's a TikTok famous girl. Now one of those like correspondents on red carpets and whatnot. And so she was invited to do like the E! Pre-show for the Met. And so she got dressed up and she used the trending TikTok sound from Marie Antoinette, Let Them Eat Cake, to show her outfit. And then it like zoomed out and it was just like her outside the Met. And like everyone's just like, anyways, people just ripped her apart. And, you know, it was definitely out of taste because obviously the Met Gala is already up against like protests, especially in New York City for the Palestinian movement and like ending the it's just like bad timing, this crescendo of mistakes and you know, a hunger to tear down the elite and whatnot. And she's the easy target because she's, you know, hasn't really contributed anything positive to society as just a TikTok star. Anyway, she's been completely eviscerated and part of this like there's this trend that's really stupid and like illogical to block celebrities.
Oh yes, blacklisting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, blacklisting, which is so performative, and I could go on a rant about it. But the point is, she peaked at 10 million the day of the Met Gala, and then that video went viral, and she lost like, you know, 100,000 or whatever. So like nothing that big. But anyways, it's interesting because her apology video was basically like, I'm a normal person. But she emphasizes over and over and over again using like clips and like screenshots to be like, everyone was using the sound. I just use trending sounds. And it is just like, it's interesting because one, people should just have more common sense. But two, it was a trending sound. I'd seen it on a bunch of things. Maybe it was too on the nose to be doing it for the Met Gala. But it also works into this movie where it's like, we want to blame young girls, these starlets who are sort of like just existing in the world they've been placed in. Not to rob anyone of their responsibility, but more just how meta it became that it was like, her using this sound that's used in the movie that plays into this idea of, isn't it pretty, isn't it shiny, but at what cost? I don't know. It's just like, you guys all need to slow down.
I feel like, I mean, in a lot of regards, like, I like cancel culture because I do feel like it holds people accountable. And there's lots of people who, do crappy things. And, like, I'm fine with them being canceled. But also sometimes it goes too far, or like, I don't know, like just gets in the weeds about things. Like, why are we like, of the things going on in the world right now that we need to be focusing on, like this random like B-list influencer who's doing a TikTok with a sound from a movie that she hasn't probably seen. It's like, this is so low on the priority list of stuff to be dealing with. Like, there are celebrities at the Met Gala who have done heinous things. You know, there's like all kinds of billionaires and stuff who are going to that. Like, maybe let's pick out the guy who was there, who was like the heir to the salmon farming empire, and, you know, like question him rather than somebody who like, is she a regular person? Like, okay, maybe not necessarily because she does have a big platform and whatnot, but also it's like, if you're a random TikToker, you kind of are a regular person in some regards. Like,
at least very, very, very new money, right? Like, it's she now has a $17,000. It's like
most people don't
rent.
Know, who she is.
Yeah.
And like, if you're an influencer, like, yes, you're making a lot of money off of some very specific things, but also like, you're not, because you don't have a real job. Like, you know, you're getting a bunch of free crap, but that's mostly what you're getting. And you have to pay taxes on all that.
Well, and that's the thing too with this, like, it's like, don't follow her then. Like, you don't have to, participate in her content. Like, that's a choice for all of us. That's like where we line up, is like your morals dictate what you're willing to enjoy, put up with, whatever. But it's like the amount of content that has been made about blocking her and others is content that elevates their content. Like, even if it is like, oh, look, we got,
right, because I would have never heard of her before.
Yeah. It's just a complete waste of energy, because there's already people, like, if you truly care about what's going on in Gaza or supporting the Palestinian movement, there are people who have been on the front lines of that making real efforts. And some white dude who's like, let's block all the celebrities, is not the guy that you should finally be like, oh yeah, that's the amount of involvement I'm going to get into. Like, that's the project I'm doing. Because it is just content farming, because then you get to make up your block list video and feel good about yourself. And it's just like, yeah, we're just, well, also, we're learning, like, the wrong lessons.
Were you following these people to begin with? You know, like,
I know, right?
Like, were you following this girl and now you're blocking her? Like, doubtful. You probably have also never heard of her before.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that was just my itching for a pop culture roundup moment. Because it was just like, you know, the Met Gala, I have my issues with, but it doesn't really, the issues, I don't know, the popularization of social movements kind of diminishes the work that's actually being done, like, mm-hmm. on the ground, especially with people in those communities who have been trying to make movements for a long time, that, like, something like this being the trigger point just feels so elementary and kind of like you're not making any waves with that. Like, honestly, be for real.
Yeah. And this,
anyways,
yeah, this is where we also get into, I feel like, the darkest timeline of Kirsten Dunst's career, where there's a period, I think, that sort of goes between now and when she finally does Fargo, with the one exception of Melancholia, where it's basically like she's in sort of nothing good or anything that takes off. Yeah. In 2007, she has Spider-Man 3. In 2008, she has How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, which is like a British comedy that didn't do well. Then in 2010, she has All Good Things, which you said you'd seen.
Yeah.
That's the Ryan Reynolds or Ryan Gosling, like, thriller.
Yeah. The Robert Durst, you know, true crime. But this was the period where she was treated for depression, and she was like, she was seen going to rehab, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, another one bites the dust. She's a drug addict. And when she left and started filming All Good Things, she had to come out and be like, guys, I was there for depression. I want to, like, say that now, but you guys should know better than, like, gossiping about things you don't know. So another reason she's a relatable queen. Obviously sad that she went through that, but glad she had, you know, the resources to be able to pull through, come out stronger, and has seemed to have had an uptick in her general, yeah, just finding out where she wants to be and what she wants to do. And so I think that explains sort of that gap, but All Good Things wasn't great, I'll be honest.
She's also in, like, a bunch of different short films. She, like, writes and directs a couple of short films in here. And then in 2011, we get Melancholia, which you, yes, just watched for the first time.
I did.
What were your thoughts?
You know, some of it was a little bit too, like, artsy for my taste. Like, it's like, okay, we get it. Like, I don't need this 30-minute intro of, like, extreme slow-mo of everything. But I did like the, like, actual pieces, like the stories of the sisters, and kind of, you know, as someone who's, let's say, dabbled in depression or, you know, anxiety, and seen that in my family and friends, the reflection on it and how it can just, like, derail a perfectly good day you shouldn't be having any problems with, I think was interesting and, like, obviously beautifully done by the two of them.
Yeah. Also, I think the, like, end of the world plot line, because basically there's, like, a giant meteor that's coming towards Earth.
It's a planet.
A planet, yeah. And I think that that is really fascinating to think about, especially in our time where, you know, with climate change and global warming and pollution and all kinds of things. It's like you don't really know when the Earth will be destroyed at some point. And so what like daily life looks like in the face of that, I think is also a really interesting
Well, and plot it plays line. Into this like interesting, like proven sociological thing, which is it's the people who like, because Jack Bauer, he plays, he's the husband of one of the women, and he's always been like, don't worry, it's going to be fine. Like, please, you just have to ignore it. Let's carry on, carry on, carry on. Believe in science. It's not going to hit us. And then he ends up killing himself before it happens because he can't handle the fact that it's actually going to happen. Whereas his depressed and anxious wife is the one who's like so scared of it, but she doesn't. Am I remembering this right? She doesn't kill herself, right?
Which one? Who is his wife?
The sister, the brunette.
No, because they're sitting at the together yeah, at the yeah. end, aren't they?
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, because I was like, I had to watch it in two parts, so I just want to make sure I'm quoting this right. But I so liked then that.
She wins Wimbledon at the end, and he runs out.
Yeah.
And, she's in a beauty pageant, no, it's but then Claire, the sister yeah. gets run over yeah. by a truck.
Yeah. No, yeah. So when he, yeah, so John, the husband, kills himself. And I think that's so interesting because that's like true that people have seen where it's like the people who are like this like faux positivity and, you know, turn your head around, blah, 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 we can get through anything. They're actually more likely to sort of in these real disaster scenarios give up much quicker than people who are depressed and kind of pessimistic to begin with, which is interesting because you picture the survivors as the ones who are like, we got this, you know, like, let's get going. So I liked that detail too, where it's like, actually, you know, depression, anxiety isn't going to be the thing that ruins your life.
Well, you I can think you're still a sturdier person. Like yeah. you're used to going on a daily basis of like things not going well and having yeah. to like move on anyways. Whereas if your life has all been, you know, sunshine and roses and then some big terrible thing happens, you're just not built yeah. to cope with that.
Yeah.
Melancholia got like a bunch of indie award kind of things. And I think Kirsten Dunst should have gotten like an Oscar nomination for this because she's incredible. But alas, this is one of those movies where she, you know, just sort of like store this in goodwill for later. Then like you watch... talked about.
Oh, yeah.
Did you watch Bachelorette? Yeah. I did not watch Bachelorette.
it's
Have
funny.
Have you seen Bachelorette?
It's, yeah, I watched good? It when it came out. It's good. I mean, it's Isla Fisher, Rebel Wilson, Lizzie Kaplan, and then Kirsten Dunst. And it's sort of like this get to the party situation, but it's these bridesmaids or at a bachelorette party that goes awry. And it's played a lot more like realistic than something like what's the dude's one where they go to Vegas?
Hangover.
But it was fun. I mean, it's like I thought it was good. It's not
I
like,
love the Scarlett Johansson Bachelorette trip movie with Broad City Girl. Rough Night. I thought that was so funny. Nobody liked that, but I loved that.
This isn't as quirky as that. This is like not a dark comedy, but kind of like, it's not necessarily something, it's not like laugh out loud comedy. It's kind of more like a drama, but it is a comedy. Yeah. I don't know how to explain
Interesting. It. Interesting. I don't know if you liked did it. On the Road, which is an adaptation of the Kerouac novel, which I have never seen, but is supposedly terrible. Like,
yeah, I never saw
like,
it.
Sort of like universally hated movie that has a lot of famous person in it. Did you see Upside Down, this romantic science sci-fi movie that she's in? I had never heard of this.
I don't think so.
In 2012 with her and Jim Sturgis. I'm like, interesting. Do no. I need to watch that? Let's see if the reviews were good. 27% yeah. on Rotten Tomatoes. So that's going to be a no.
You know what? Maybe I did see it. These screenshots are making me think I have, and it was very dumb. Because it's like, oh, yeah, it's like another Melancholia thing where you're like, what? But it's there's a twin.
Is it like is it like Anne Hathaway's Passengers?
about it's like there's
where
twin
everybody's
world,
been
so
dead the whole time, but there's
so
just
we
people
have
on plane.
Our world, but then there's a world connected to ours that has the reverse like gravity.
Well, yeah, it's called the Upside Down. so they really stole the Stranger Things plot line from this movie. Crazy. Exactly. Copyright infringement.
Exactly,
you know, if Taylor Swift had written this movie, she'd be getting 50% of the royalties from Stranger Things at this point.
Literally.
She has her famous Bling Ring cameo in 2013.
Yeah, iconic.
Love. She's also in Anchorman 2, briefly.
Saw it.
The Two Faces of January, I have never heard of, but this is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel, who wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley and also stars Viggo Mortensen and Oscar Isaac. So I'm like, is this movie for me?
And then we get
And it has an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
yeah, I'm trying to think. Now I'm feeling like I saw more Kirsten Dunst than I even could have ever known.
Why? But do you think you saw that movie and can't remember it?
Yeah.
Well, then 2015, we get Fargo, which we already sort of talked about briefly. But she comes into the second season of Fargo, which is an anthology series. Yeah. And this is where she meets her future husband, Jesse Plemons. They play the local butcher and his hairdresser wife. And,
she's
you know, they get involved. In a crime. Yeah, she's doing the Midwestern accent the whole time. And I think that this was at the very beginning of the period where movie actresses were going to TV shows. I think this was a very like big get for them to get her in this. And she did such a good job. She got tons of award nominations for this. I think this is sort of like when the renaissance of her career started. Unfortunately, she was up against Sarah Paulson for the OJ American Crime Story. So she basically lost everything that year, unfortunately, even though I think that's a really good performance in Fargo. And she would have won a bunch of an Emmy and such in any other year.
She was my favorite part.
Yeah,
I'll
she's
say,
definitely
I'll
the
say,
best
I'll say
part.
The Fargo as a whole, it was a little long, a little slow. I didn't care about 90% of them. I don't actually care about any of them, but she and Jesse were the best. They were having fun. They were having a good time. I was rooting for them. It didn't work out, but I was rooting for them.
In Fargo, it's always like mostly bad people, and most of them die at the end, so it's sort of hard to really like root for people other than I guess like the cops. But then in today's age, cops are not as rootable as they used to be. Also, the thing with Fargo is like the second season doesn't really build on the first season, but I think some of the second season builds on the first season slightly. So if you'd watch the first season, you have like a little bit more investment in like the cop family. The second season, I think, is the best season of Fargo. I also really love season three. Season four, which is the one where it's like a Chris Rock and they're in Missouri for some reason, I think is not good. And then I haven't watched season five yet, but
yeah,
that's the John Hamm season. It's supposed to be great.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
No, I don't know. I did see Midnight Special, which is the 2016 Netflix movie.
I don't think it's a Netflix movie. I saw it in theaters.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
This is the movie where it's Jaden Martell, who was like the child actor at the time, and it's sort of like an E.T. kind of thing where like he has some sort of supernatural power, and it's and she plays his mom, and like they're kind of like cult people, like she has cult lady hair in the movie for whatever reason, and they're trying to like get the kid out of the cult to meet a spaceship or something. Yeah, I liked it. I remember liking it. Fun. I don't know if I would like it necessarily as much if I rewatched it, but I liked it at the time. This year, she was also in Hidden Figures as sort of, you know, the like white woman who works at NASA who's like mean, but then turns out to be good in the end, I think.
Classic.
Or she's okay. And then she reteams up with Sofia Coppola yet again for The Beguiled in 2017, which I love The Beguiled.
I remember talking about this.
On the podcast? Or in, or at the office?
I don't know. Or IRL, or just ranting to me one day, or maybe on the podcast it came up.
The Beguiled, I can't remember if they're Confederate people or if they're
Confederate.
They're Confederate.
Yeah, and they're on the Confederate side.
Yeah, so it's all of these like Southern women who have been left alone in this house while the men, you know, go off and fight the war. And a, I guess, Union soldier played by Colin Farrell shows up at the house injured one day. And they're kind of like, what do we do? He's like the wrong side, but he seems nice. And it's just about how this one man like is able to sort of like, these women are so like desperate for attention, depressed, and horny, and have been locked up for so long that he's able to play them all off of each other and work them all up into a frenzy where they're sort of like all turning on each other. And then you get to an infamous scene where they all band together and poison him with mushrooms. And it's a Sofia Coppola movie. So it's like sort of Nothing Happens, and it's about a bunch of sad girls, and I loved every second of it. And that's that. Then she's also in a horror movie or a thriller called Woodshock, which I have not seen.
No, I didn't see either, but this was another one where her friends, two women, were directing this. It was their first film, and she's like, yeah, I'll be in it. So look at her being a girl's girl.
At her being a girl's girl.
Didn't do well, but she did it.
The next thing she's in is she does another TV series on becoming a god in Central Florida. Did you watch this?
No, but this was her first like production. She executive produced it. And yeah, it was supposed to get a second season, but COVID.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I watched the first season. It's like 10 episodes, and I think it's like a half hour. It's a comedy, sort of. She is a woman who lives in Florida and becomes involved in like a multi-level marketing scheme, and her husband, I want to say, gets eaten by an alligator, and Alexander Skarsgård, and so then she sort of has to sort of take on the business responsibility and become, you know, like this MLM woman.
Is that the same Skarsgård from Melancholia?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Cute.
Yeah, so I don't, maybe they're friends and she recruited him. But yeah, it's a good, cute little like funny, entertaining show. It also, I think it might have the guy who is her son in Power of the Dog. Does it, or am I making that up? Is it a different skinny white boy who's in that show?
Could be.
No, it does not look like he's in it. But apparently Davine Joy Randolph is in that show, which I forgot about, but now that I'm looking at the credits, she is in it. So interesting development there. But then, so that's 2019. Then she comes back in 2021 with The Power of the Dog, which is where she and Jesse both get their first Oscar nominations.
Very cute.
Just a really great performance. I'm sure we talked about it on the podcast 9 million times.
Yeah.
Out. And then Civil War. And that's it for currently.
Yeah. I mean, Civil War, she didn't even have to audition. They were just like, yeah, she wants it, that's great. And I love that, because I love Civil War, and I know you're a hater, and I've honestly gotten multiple people feedbacking to me that your take was bonkers to them, but that's fine. It's not called Because You're Wrong for nothing.
Civil War was not like a beloved movie. Lots of people hated
it. I'm saying your take on it specifically had people scratching their heads. Okay.
Which part of my take? As being like
anti-journalism. They did not get that at all.
I don't think that that's a hot take.
That is, it's
anyways.
It's a bad take.
It was a bad movie is what it was.
No, good, it's not. It's a good movie. It's a great movie. I still think about it. It was a very successful, heinous movie. Oh, it was not heinous. That's just, you just digging your heels
in. One of the worst movies of the year, honestly.
Honestly, that's pathetic of you to say. It doesn't make any sense for you to say that. It was a great, well-done film, and a lot of that relied on Kirsten Dunst. And in fact, you should be glad I liked it so much because that's why I chose Kirsten Dunst for my birthday. So
wow. Okay. Well, I'll give it that. The one good thing to come out of that movie. She has one movie coming up that's in post-production called Rhubarb, which the log line is, two adult siblings try their best to navigate the individual and shared grief following their beloved dog's death. So I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to relate to these characters, and this will not probably be another movie by Kirsten Dunst that I don't love, yeah, but whatever. Dog people,
well, it's sure interesting we'll because, great, you know, everyone's like, oh, you've been taking breaks. And she's like, yeah, I mean, I was sick of being offered sad mom roles. And that was like the headline that got pulled. But she's like, no. She clarified that she's like, I'm in a lucky position where it's not hard to get roles. I just don't want to work on things because most things aren't very good.
Yes.
Queen behavior. I love that for her. And she's like, I deserve to be picky. Yeah, she's working on that comedy I think she wants to do. She has plans to, like, produce a movie with Jesse, her husband.
The thing is, like, if you make, you know, $1 million or whatever per movie that you're in, and you also have, like, income coming in from Spider-Man and various other movies that are, you know, are constantly making money in the background, it's like, how much money do you actually need per year?
I know, right?
If you're just sort of living a normal life, like, yeah, you can do one movie every 2 years. And also the thing about film shoots is, like, a lot of the times you have to be gone for that entire period. It's, yeah, not like if you're filming a TV show where it's like on a sound set and you get to drive home every night. Like when she filmed Civil War, like, where was that film? Georgia or something? Like, that's, it's really a lot of time and work, and those are long days, especially if you're the main character and you're in all of the scenes. Like, I can see why you wouldn't necessarily want to be doing that constantly if you didn't have to, especially if it was going to be a crappy movie that was going to get bad reviews anyway. Like, yeah.
A crappy movie has never stopped her, but, no, I think that similarly, she was supposed to, like, direct a movie and it didn't really work out. It fell apart, and people have asked her since, like, oh, do you want to direct? And she's like, I just don't have the drive to be the leader of a film right now. I get to go home and not think about things, and I'm not in the zone of wanting to do that at this point in life. So she's just comfortable. And I think, yeah, obviously anyone acting is in a pretty privileged position to begin with, but she's also lucky that a lot of her stuff was, like, before streaming, before these new contracts that seem to really limit the residuals and the you know, returns on investment of time and whatnot. And so she doesn't have to be hustling in the same way as Sydney Sweeney seems to have to be. But yeah, she's just, like, owning the fact that she doesn't care to do more than she wants at this point.
Well, so, I think we'll, if you're, see, young, there's, like, that strike while the iron's hot mentality of, like, take everything. But she's been in the business for 30 some years. So, like, she's not going anywhere. Everybody knows who Kirsten Dunst is. A fun fact about Kirsten Dunst, which I will forever remember and think was probably based in misogyny looking back at it. In college, one of my history professors, I don't know why he brought this up, but somebody or another at some point, like, either asked who his least favorite actor was, or he brought up that fact, and he said that Kirsten Dunst was his least favorite actor. And at the time, I remember thinking, like, huh, like, weird, because I don't feel like she's been that bad in, like, things.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I sort of hadn't, like, re-looked at all of her work yet, or hadn't watched a lot of it. So I was just thinking, like, Spider-Man and stuff. But I'm like, she doesn't seem so terrible that, like, that's who you would pick. But now I'm like, oh, that was definitely, like, chauvinism.
Yeah.
That some, like, 6-year-old white man at a Christian Republican school was like, yeah, you know who my least favorite actor, who the worst actor of all is? Kirsten Dunst. Like, no. Yes. There's at least one person worse than Kirsten Dunst in every movie that she has ever been in. And in most movies, it's everybody's worse than her. So, deranged. No, yeah.
I mean, hopefully people agree with us and they're happy we talked for 2 hours about her. An hour and a half, you know, reasonable.
An hour and a half. We're going fast.
Yeah.
It helped that we had talked about a lot of her stuff on other episodes, I guess.
Yeah.
But Yeah, no, this is great. Happy birthday. Did you do anything Thank exciting you. To celebrate?
Let's see. Yeah, I had dinner. All of my presents were late in the mail, I guess, so that's not very nice, but it just means my birthday continues.
Okay. I did not send you anything. I'm sorry.
That's who I was waiting on. I was sure something was... You didn't? I shouldn't.
Wait. Yes. Yes, I did. It got so delayed. It's coming from the upside down, and I don't think it had transferred over yet.
Yeah.
Just you wait. It's a bunch of film that you have to develop while you're on the drive sort of like shake in your hand canister because we're not
that.
Doing
That's
digital
how,
anymore.
Yeah.
We're just doing real developed
That's how
film.
All film technically works is by hand, but I understand your point. Yeah.
That can't be true.
Yes,
all
that's
film
what developing
is developed
film
by
is.
Hand?
Yes,
there has to
you...
be a machine that does that.
That's just...
You're telling me there's not a machine that they just put the negatives in and somehow it makes... There's
Matthew,
no way that
Matthew,
every...
That's what film is. That's why what? Film costs money to develop. It's like,
well, yeah, but
still
I thought,
an art form. Okay,
so you're
like,
saying
respect.
That if I take my disposable camera, that some random man is developing those one at a time by hand?
I mean, not like one at a time. Like, what do you mean?
Like he's like putting it in the water and shaking it, like it's
yes,
like
yes, you have to use a chemical. It's
wait,
that's
but
how
I assumed
photography
it was some kind
works.
Of machine that did that now. It was a machine that you just put the negatives in and it, like, I don't know, does something like a copy machine or something.
Oh my gosh. No. This
you
is just...
don't know. When was the last time you developed film?
I got film developed. I have a relationship with Richard's photography and I send him my film and then he's like, okay, here are the people handling it, blah, 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 color corrections. Oh, do you want these scanned? Sure. Here you go. So eat that. Honestly.
Wow.
Disrespectful.
Rude. Okay, well, happy birthday, Shelby.
Thanks.
33 has never looked so good.
Thank you.
And yeah, well, we're off next week. I am taking a beach trip convalescence.
Cute.
Sort of Beth March-esque
yes.
Vibes.
You deserve
and
it.
And hopefully I don't die of yellow fever or whatever it was that she got. And and then we'll be back after that to talk about Furiosa, I believe.
Ooh.
So, exciting stuff.
Wonderful.
Which I'm actually seeing
wait.
Tomorrow. So
oh my gosh, rude.
I'm fancy like that. If you only you lived in New York, Shelby, you could have come.
Oh, could I? You have a
well,
plus one?
I do have a plus one, but actually they specified very clearly multiple times that it had to be a non-industry plus one. And
oh,
I was
interesting.
Like, this is like, I've never had that happen before. I don't know if you would have counted as industry or not since you have a
I
podcast,
so.
but they also made me provide the name. So I think that they like searched. So I couldn't have been like,
oh, weird.
Oh yeah, I'm bringing, you know, Ebert and Roper with me or whoever. And then they'd be like, oh no, they're film critics. But anyways, happy birthday.
Thank you
everyone
thank
for
you.
Listening. Go support Kirsten Dunst's filmography. You should watch them all. They're all great, except for all the ones that we didn't actually see because they're lost time. And we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Bye.